Making Media tells the story of our media business, Colossus. If you aren't familiar with our platform, make sure to check out joincolossus.com. There you'll find our latest episodes across each of our shows, the transcripts, supporting third-party materials, and even some written content as well. So whether you're an investor or an operator, we're out to create the content that we wish we had when we were in those exact roles. Invest Like the Best, Business Breakdowns, Web3 Breakdowns, and Founders each cover different angles of the ecosystem. And our special series like 50X and Return on India are targeting niche topics. Again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com for more on the platform.
Let's do this.
Welcome to Making Media.
Humans are in an eternal quest for convenience. Save me time, make my life easier.
Gosh, that was such a good start to an interview.
Welcome back to Making Media. Our guest today is Jack Davenport. Jack is the managing director and co-founder of British-based Goalhanger Podcasts. Goalhanger is the largest independent podcast network in the UK and likely the world outside of the US. Their stable of shows do 30 million downloads a month, which, let me tell you, is incredibly impressive. Goalhanger got its first big breakthrough with the excellent history podcast called The Rest is History, and they've since grown into other verticals like politics, finance, football, and entertainment, a lot of the times under the same banner, The Rest Is. Their model focuses on co-hosts with chemistry, and they publish frequently, two or three times a week. I should also mention that Jack's co-founder is Gary Lineker, the English footballing and broadcasting legend. It was great fun to talk all things podcasting with someone who's taking the medium by storm. Really hope you enjoy the conversation, and stick around at the end for the debrief with Matt. Jack, we're really pleased to have you on the show. You have built a huge podcasting business in this country, in the UK. It might not be as familiar to some of our international listeners. So I want to start with you explaining what Goalhanger is, its origin story, and a brief description about what you do.
Thank you for having me. Right now, Goalhanger is the biggest independent audio production company outside the US by monthly downloads. That's probably true. We're about 30 million downloads a month across our shows. Our main series is The Rest Is. So we have The Rest Is History, The Rest Is Politics, The Rest Is Football, The Rest Is Money, and The Rest Is Entertainment, as well as five or six other podcasts within the network with different names. The Rest Is has become the brand that we're most known for in the UK and has got a decent footprint now worldwide, about a million downloads a month in the US and a decent audience in Australia and other sort of English-speaking territories as well. I think The Rest Is History is the biggest history podcast. It's certainly one or two in the US now as well. We started life as a TV production company. So we're co-owned by Gary Lineker, who in the UK is probably the most well-known sports anchor on TV, a former professional soccer player himself. Once it was England's greatest ever scorer. So one of the top names in British media. Started as a TV production company specializing in sport documentaries, operating in a very sort of traditional commission space for an independent production company, doing commissions for people like the BBC, FIFA, mainly documentaries around big sporting personalities, soccer, boxing. Started dipping their toes into podcasting in 2018 with a show with Gary, the co-owner. I think the big left turn and what's led us to where we are today is took a punt on a history podcast in 2019, focusing around the Second World War. It's called We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Still going now, good 700 or so episodes later. Found a really strong niche audience for history. And that kind of opened our eyes into the opportunity we thought there was specifically in history at the time for chat format shows with high volume based around a great relationship. The issue we ran into with We Have Ways of Making You Talk was that in terms of World War II history, even though it's the most popular genre of history, if you go into a bookshop, once you're sort of 50 or 60 episodes in, you're so kind of in the weeds that it's quite hard to pick up new listeners who have a more general interest. That's why we created The Rest Is History, because we wanted a history podcast that could talk to the broadest possible audience of people who were vaguely interested in history. The Rest Is History covers essentially the entire span of human existence. The conception was always to keep the barrier to entry very low. Each episode is its kind of own standalone thing, or now it's their sort of mini series. So three, four episodes on a specific subject. You can pick it up and If you're interested in Henry VIII, you can listen to our Tudor episodes. If you're interested in Watergate, you can listen to our episodes about Richard Nixon. By doing that, we've been able to continue growing really strongly since 2020 when it launched. So it was the success of that podcast, The Rest is History, that clarified in our minds that the future in terms of what we wanted to be as a company was podcasts and audio first rather than the sort of more traditional TV model that we'd come from. We spun off Goalhanger Podcasts as a separate company in January 2022, based around The Rest is History, but also about that model of podcasting. So it's original IP that we monetize primarily through ad revenue and then attempt to grow the audience. And after that point, branch into sort of other monetization models like subscription and live events. First show we did in the new business was The Rest is Politics, which just timings wise in the UK, I think it was 2 weeks before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And then we had a insane sort of political summer where Boris Johnson was hounded out of office, followed by Liz Truss, Richie. So three prime ministers in a year, just a crazy news cycle that strapped a rocket to the growth of the show. And it became a massive, biggest podcast in the UK by some distance in about 6 months. That was 2022. And then we pretty much built out through there. Now attacking sort of different verticals, more The Rest is shows, obviously, yeah, football, entertainment, more history, other current events pods, and yeah, now looking to expand more aggressively overseas.
A really good overview of where you've come from. I'm curious for that first left turn into history, like you said, and then another turn into politics, and you've grown from there. With each of those, was it more luck and happenstance that there was a personality that you wanted to build something around? Or was it, we were just picking off niches in a very broad sense? Which bit is driving the model? Is it the person or is it the topic?
Our background was sport, but my background, I worked in linear radio. So I've always been a massive audio listener, worked in it and around it. It was obvious to me in 2018, I left the BBC because they felt like there was an opportunity specifically in audio, but my background was also sport, as was Goalhanger's. And that's one area where it's a much more crowded marketplace. Even though podcasting is thought of as like a new media, there's very established media properties in football, soccer. We shied away from doing that. It did feel that things like history and politics, there were big potential audience appetites for. There was nothing that I quite listened to. We tried to make products for ourselves. So it did feel like there was a gap in the market and we were trying to do that. From history to politics and the way we were doing it, it probably wasn't like a massive leap audience-wise that a good percentage of our audience who were interested in our history would also be interested in politics. So we'd be able to cross-promote it and give it a good start. That was our most basic understanding of how we're going to get an audience to it straight away. We also picked quite well with the talent in, firstly, that brilliant combination, the pretty well-known big-name politicians in the UK terms. You know, it was Tony Blair's right-hand man and the person who lost to Boris Johnson in the Conservative leadership race in 2019. They were big names that we were able to put together.
It's interesting. You don't hear too many folks going from video to audio with the TV background and production company behind that. Was there something about the success of that first podcast and seeing the growth and the reception that made you particularly want to lean into this and do more of it? It's counter to, I think, what a lot of people do. So I'm curious if there was anything specific going on there which triggered the light bulb to say, we want to spend more time doing this.
One thing I left out of my soliloquy at the start about the history of Goalhanger is that when it was a TV production company, I wasn't involved in it. I was working in audio at that time in linear radio. Audio has always been my focus. And I think what was liberating from the video side is that, firstly, the way we started all the pods was so light lift production-wise compared to what you have to do to get something TV off the ground. It was exactly what we're doing now, sitting in front of a computer with a little microphone plugged into it. That's your fixed cost base. I produced the first 75 episodes on my own without getting paid. We just all did it without really knowing what was going to come from it. So very low barriers to entry technically and easy to take a punt on something and get started. And I think also the freedom of, I have a little bit of experience in this world. My business partner's a lot more, but it's just a lot more rewarding to be able to back your own ideas and let the audience decide whether they're any good or not, compared to convincing one commissioner at one platform that it's good or not. And then if it is good, here's the budget and try and eke out a 15% margin from it. When it works, it's fantastic. You're masters of your own destiny. So that was the root of it. I mean, ironically, now I'm sitting here in our offices and probably 90% of the staff that I've hired in the last 6 months have been video, you know, editors, but it's for YouTube or Facebook or digital. So it's going full circle again, but just not for linear TV in the same way that Goalhanger would have been operating 5-10 years ago.
Funny how the circle of life works. You come back, maybe slightly different in terms of the video, as you mentioned, but it all comes back. And when you look at where you stand today, I think a lot of businesses that end up doing podcasts use the podcast as a funnel into other areas of the business. But how would you classify the different buckets of revenue that you are generating from? And is there any big standouts, if you can roughly sketch, between whether it's advertising, some type of subscription or membership, events? How do you frame the business in that regard?
Our main revenue source is still ad revenue. We partner with Spotify in the UK, much smaller operation in terms of direct sales, post-read ads, we'd call them over here. So I think we're one of three partners they have in the UK for ads, as well as Megaphone programmatic network. I would say probably 60% of our revenue comes from ad revenue still, and our shows are tailored towards very high volume, probably twice, three times a week, every week of the year, always on most of our shows. Very deliberately targeting volume in that sense. In terms of the other sources of revenue, I think the most exciting is probably the direct-to-consumer subscription membership clubs, we call them. Charge £5-6 a month. So I guess that's like $7.50 or something like that for access to bonus content, ad-free, chat communities, early access to live tickets we found to be a big driver. We've rolled that out by individual podcast rather than as a network. So you subscribe to The Rest is History rather than the Goalhanger Network. And so that means that we're able to tailor the offering to each individual podcast to suit that show and the kind of availability of talent that we have. But for some of the shows that we have, that on an individual show basis, that is more than 50% of the revenue mix now. In terms of a business and monthly returning revenue, that's a massively powerful thing. It's something we're really excited about. And we've grown a lot over the last year and is something we continue to lean into. Live events is nice if you can get it right and you can get to a big enough scale. So in the UK, we've sold out the Royal Albert Hall a couple of times, which is about 5,500 capacity for the politics show. And we've actually just gone on sale for an arena tour of venues between capacity 5,000 to 10,000. We've got 7 shows in the UK for the politics show, hopefully in the lead up to the election in October this year. Overall, there'll be about 35,000 tickets available, and we're probably 60% of the way there after 2 weeks. So we hopefully will get close to sell out of that tour. So at that scale, it can really work. There's also probably a scale at which it doesn't make sense as much. It's not quite as scalable in the same way as digital product, obviously. The one thing that we haven't quite worked out in the UK compared to the what I understand from the US live events market for podcasts and things like that is that there's not really a market for selling the sponsorship of the show to a brand. I understand that can be quite powerful in the US, and if we could replicate that over here, that could make them much more compelling in terms of PR and getting the word out about the show and building that relationship with the audience. They're fantastic. The talent love doing them, so it's something that we'll look to keep doing. We're hopefully coming over to the States as well for an 8-date tour for The Rest is History in November. That's a really good outreach and way to show our US audience that we care about them, and we're sort of thinking about them, focusing our content on them, hopefully keep growing the audience over there.
In terms of the membership offering, you mentioned that the early access to those live tickets is a big reason why people sign up. Is that the reason, or do you have a sense for the main drivers of people joining those clubs? You hear community a lot, but I'm always conscious about like what does it actually look like for the people signing up, and why do they do it on an annual basis?
We've run surveys around this, and when we started, the biggest driver we found was just wanting to support the show, really liking it and just thinking this is a really good thing. We want it to continue. Not that we marketed it as we need this to survive. we've always looked to have the membership club as like a nice additional extra. We've never like paywalled content that was previously free. It's all bonus stuff that you get if you like serving that super fan level. One thing that's been really good for The Rest Is History recently is we hit on this formula of doing slightly longer series, so 4 or 6 part miniseries about the Aztecs, the Spanish conquistadors, and the early access after episode 1 to say, if you can't wait for the 2.5 weeks that we're going to release this over, if you want access to everything now, then you can sign up to the club. That's been really powerful. We've seen huge take-ups off the back of that.
You've referenced your hosts before. They enjoy the events, which is nice to hear. Can definitely have hosts going in either direction with that. Can you share a little bit about how you've come to find your hosts? You have some very big names. Those relationships, how it's either structured or come to, and a little bit more about how you think about hosts as part of the platform.
I would say we're very host and talent centric as a company. We're very aware that what we want to create is partnerships that the audience wants to feel part of. They want to feel like they're part of a friendship between the two hosts and the listener, effectively. We completely understand that that's who the listeners are building that relationship with. When you're operating the commercial model that we are with big names in a UK context, but we need to get them to buy into commercializing in the way we do, reading ads, that kind of stuff, we have very generous deals with them, which they're effectively stakeholders and partners in the shows. They're incentivized in the upside in the same way that we all are. And that's been really central to our model because, again, coming from a more traditional background, when someone's turning up for a fee compared when someone can see all the information and can see the direct benefit between them reading an advert for whoever it might be and how much money we can pay them at the end of the month, that's a much better position to be in as an ask. Very generous with hosts. In terms of how we've worked with the big names, we have a massive competitive advantage over here in being co-owned by Gary Lineker because that just opens a lot of doors for you. He knows a lot of people. And if he doesn't know them, to be honest, he can just DM them on Instagram. Our process is not more complicated than that sometimes, but it's surprisingly effective. We have such a strong proof of concept now. And on a normal week, if I looked now, we'd probably have 4 of the top 10 podcasts on the Apple charts, 3 in the Spotify charts. So we have a pretty strong proof of concept now for new talent that we want to work with.
How much do you push down onto the hosts, particularly if you're starting a new show, for example, and you have a big name that you're talking to? There have been some prominent examples of big names starting podcasts that don't last, particularly because they don't understand the long-term nature of doing a podcast. You need to be there weekly for your audience, sometimes 2 or 3 times a week. They do a couple of months and decide that that's not for them. Are you very clear with them from the outset that, hey, if you want the success, we can do the economic part of it where we are partners, but you also need to be showing up all the time, talking about what you're doing and why, and really buying into the project?
There's no point going in with unrealistic expectations on anyone's part. So we're able to forecast pretty well now what we think the potential could be. And if you're doing a podcast and if you're a decent name talent, you're not doing it to make money out of the first 20 episodes. You're doing it because 6, 9, 12 months down the line, you've built to a point where you're at a really good base. And then if you can get to that really solid base that then becomes worth your while, you've then got the opportunity, if you can sort of cross over, to suddenly really escalate what the potential is for you. So absolutely, they have to buy into the potential upside, but we have a strong proof of concept now that we have historians making 7 figures sitting at home making podcasts. They work really hard to do that, but that is what is possible from this. So you have to be upfront, and I think that's served us well so far.
How much of the marketing function is taken off them or centralized across the shows? Or is it, if you want to talk about your show, it's on you because the relationship is with you? Or is it, we're going to do this much collateral during the week based on recordings, videos, etc., that we can push out and you can either tweet it on your own account or we can do it through the central Goalhanger account?
For the majority of our existence, our marketing function has pretty much been our network and cross-promoting in audio on the other shows, which is just so powerful for promoting podcasts specifically. It's much more powerful if you can do it at scale than social media is, I think, because you know someone who's hearing an ad in a podcast, you know they're a podcast listener already. It's not very often that I'm scrolling through Twitter, then say, oh, now I'm fancy listening to a 45-minute podcast. I'm just going to click on that. For the first year of our existence, we were quite aggressively audio only, and that's the only thing that matters. We'll cross-promote within our own network. We'll grow the network that way, and it worked well for us. I think the video elements, the social elements, has been our big investment pretty much for the past year or so. And we're able to do it because we've got to a big enough scale in audio organically that we're able to invest in these things now. But we were put off from it by the additional difficulty, and the ask on the talent was actually quite significant. So to take the politics podcast, for example, for the first year of the show, one of the hosts lived in the Middle East and the other one London-based, but on a plane consulting all around the world every week. And essentially, we said to them, look, if you can take a pencil case worth of kit with you, we can capture not studio quality, but very high quality, high enough quality audio that people wouldn't know the difference. Whereas to do the same with video, that's been the challenge we've spent the last year trying to work out. I think we've got to a pretty good place with it with a couple of our shows, a couple we're still working out. That's an exciting area of potential, both as far as marketing goes. If we can continue to grow the accounts and the sort of awareness of the shows and the trend lines we're seeing, but also from that revenue generation point, both platform revenue and the ability to do bigger partnerships with the sponsors that may have come to us through audio, that's a huge potential growth area for us that we're investing a lot in at the moment.
And how much do you think about the Goalhanger brand versus just focusing on the individual shows themselves? Are you ever marketing for Goalhanger as a brand specifically, or is it pretty much whatever value accrues up to Goalhanger is just residual from the shows themselves?
Initially, straight out of the gate, Goalhanger was really in the background. We didn't put the name on the artwork or anything like that because we wanted people to build a relationship with those shows. One of the reasons for that was that for the first year or so we existed, the commercial function was pretty much outsourced to a third party. So Acast in the UK are the biggest audio podcast sales agency, sales house. We were with Acast. They did all of our sales. And essentially at the end of the month, they said, great news here. Here's how much money you made. Crack on. We were very heads down focused on the production. Partway through last year, we left Acast to join Spotify, as I mentioned. And one of the drivers behind that was the ability to have a little bit more freedom in terms of the partnerships we were able to do ourselves commercially. It's for that reason that who Goalhanger is as a brand has become more relevant over the last 6 months, we're realizing. I mean, I'll be hugely embarrassed if anyone listens to this podcast to our website now because it's still absolutely terrible. We've still got some work to do on Goalhanger as a brand, but we are thinking of it as our B2B brand in effect for those, hopefully in future, those big brand partnerships that we want to be getting into. The other debate we have on that front is that we have such a well-known strand with The Rest Is. We have 5 shows, which the name starts with The Rest Is now. How much do we lean into that as a brand? I think that is, in a sense, our brand, our sort of mark of quality in a lot of ways to the outside world. Should we just become The Rest Is company? Should every show we make be The Rest Is? If you've got any ideas, please tell me. Honestly, we argue about it from every week.
These are questions we ask ourselves as well. So I'm glad to know others are thinking about it too.
You often talk about branding and people will say, well, how do people describe your business? And that's probably closer than what you have called it or how you think about it internally. And, you know, a lot of the PR around your firm starts with The Rest Is company or words to that effect in the first or second paragraph. One thing I wanted to touch on with you is, and partnerships in a slightly different way to, I think, what you were just talking about there, is with other media businesses, you personally started at the BBC. Gary has very strong links to the BBC. And you also do some work, I think, with Sky and in the past, or currently Wondery, as well as another podcast business. How did those come about? Are they organic? Or how do you think about those as functions, I guess, of marketing for the firm?
We have very strong relationships with the BBC and we make effectively a commission show with them, which is the Match of the Day. It's like a football show, Match of the Day, Top 10. That is a long existing relationship that we've had with the BBC. Gary is the presenter of Match of the Day on TV. It's our kind of main soccer show on TV on a Saturday night. That sort of continues as it has done for the last 5 years or so since we've been making it. We did do a commission with Wondery in the history space that started last year. It's called Legacy. We're close to halfway through the first series of that now. It's with historians Peter Frankopan and Afua Hirsch, who are both fantastic. In general, we avoid commissions almost entirely. All the rest of our shows are originals, but I think the Wondery opportunity came to us. Wondery were quite proactive in wanting to make it happen. And for us as a business, it was a potential way into the US, essentially. We'd love to be bigger in the States. We'd love to sort of build our profile over there. So with Wondery's position in the US market, we thought it would be a good move for us. The show's really strong, obviously, because it is a commission. We don't have that much insight into the composition of the audience, but we hope that when we come over to the US, as we are doing in a month's time, to have loads of meetings, that people, that at least they might have seen something from Goalhanger, even if they haven't seen the rest is shows or anything else. So that was the reason behind that one.
And do you think about those commissions as marketing engines? BBC aside, which seems like that comes from a historic relationship, but the way you were describing the Wondery relationship almost felt like less of a economic opportunity and maybe more of a growth engine into a new market.
Yep, absolutely that. In general, we're not pitching for commissions. We're not offering our new shows around to see who wants to buy them. We're backing them and we're taking the punt. But I think where there's a bigger strategic reason for it, we will do it. And so I wouldn't rule out doing it in future, but really we're looking for those partnerships where we can retain the IP and the upside.
In terms of the growth and introducing new shows, have you felt any dilution? I think there's often this initial massive opportunity where you can take a big show, introduce a new show, and there's an opportunity to see that audience catch on with both shows. But as you expand more and more, people only have so much time. The amount of shows that you can reference is difficult. It's not an unlimited amount. I'm just curious, when you think about adding new shows and then your own experience with it, if you felt any bit of strain or dilution as time goes on and how you deal with that.
We definitely haven't felt any. The most recent show we launched, The Rest is Entertainment, was our biggest launch and is still growing. So we launched it in December, still growing really strongly. It just passed 4 million downloads in 2.5 months. Has found an audience really quickly. We haven't seen, you know, one of our other pods losing audience by equivalent. When we started the business, we started doing another history podcast from a World War II history podcast. That was pretty much our conception right at the start. We were like, people really like history podcasts. Let's make loads more history podcasts. We did probably 3 in that first year. Empire, which is fantastic success in its own right, 2.5 million downloads a month, another one of the biggest history podcasts in the world, as well as The Rest is History. We have one called Battleground, which has kind of morphed into a, almost like a current events type show. But the success of politics and the kind of way it brought us into both a different audience and also a different advertiser, essentially, that showed us the potential of maybe trying to target broader genres rather than be ultra specific within one genre. The way we view the cross promotion with our other shows is that because of the scale we have now, we can guarantee to bring people to episode one. Firstly, we have to make sure episode one's good for people to want to stick around, but just being able to bring that huge audience to something and effectively guarantee that in the UK anyway, it will go to number one in the charts and it will get the publicity around it for being the next Goalhanger show, and it will stick around in those charts for a couple of weeks. Overall, our most recent launches, that has given the shows a good enough foothold to then start finding their own natural audience and growing from that point. It's always that growth curve and the growth cycle that we're most interested in when we launch a show. Are we gaining audience? Are we losing audience? Are we plateauing? And as long as we're growing, that's going to be a positive sign as far as we're concerned.
What do your podcast launches look like internally, from initially an Instagram message or whatever it might be to a potential host, and then through those weeks or months or however long it is until you actually press the button to publish the first episode? How many, I guess, episodes are you recording to get a feel for whether these hosts are vibing with each other and whether the content is interesting? Bring us inside the room to kind of those discussions and that process.
Very dependent on the talent and individual situations. Some shows we've done half dozen pilots. Some shows it's been one show. Okay, yep, good to go. Let's crack on. I think in general, because we're doing such high volume and we're so upfront with the host, we want to get to 2 shows a week, every week of the year at some point. The show is inevitably going to sort of iterate once it's live anyway, and kind of evolve, and you kind of work out what your audience is interested in and what they're really good at. We're happy to launch something that is not 100% perfect, just knowing that the amount that we want to do, you're going to get to a point where you've met the audience and worked out what you're really good at. Some things have taken 2 years to get off the ground. Our most recent show, The Rest is Entertainment, we probably had the first meeting about it late September and it launched late November. We could have probably done it sooner than that because the two hosts are just so fantastic that they picked it up and ran with it straight away. So each individual situation is different on that. We're so aware of that relationship between the two hosts being the sort of key element to the success of the show that it's picking those two people that we will kind of take the most time over.
And do you have them go through trial runs or practice episodes to get a sense of that?
We'll do pilots, and sometimes it's just one, and then the pilot of The Rest is Politics. We probably could have put it out as is. They were just great and they just got it. Some other shows haven't been like that, but have got to a point where you kind of work it out. So the other thing that's worked quite well for us is that in general, we haven't tried to conjure relationships out of thin air. We've targeted one key talent that we want to work with. And we've said to them, look, this is the kind of show we want to make. Who would you have a really good conversation with this about? Ideally, we'd like them to be bringing something slightly different. So in the case of The Rest is Politics, most obviously it's a lefty politician or a Tory politician. Some people probably disagree with my characterization about it. It's certainly Labour and Conservative. With history, it was a historian specialist in the ancient Rome and Greece compared to a historian of modern Britain and America, in effect, the last 200 years. We're not trying to create that relationship with two strangers. We're looking to build on something that is already, at least in some way, that there's already there that we can build on.
How important is the multiple episodes a week that you talked about, of trying to get people up to two episodes a week at least? Is that something that you're insistent on? You often hear consistency is important, and whatever metric you choose, whether that's weekly, monthly, two or three times a week, is less important than the consistency element itself. But it seems like that might be slightly different with you.
It works both for consistency and building the audience. And also when you're operating on a quite straightforward CPM-based ad monetization, there's not too much differentiation between one episode that gets 100,000 downloads and two episodes that get 50,000 downloads. If you've got something that can do 100,000 downloads on one app, why would you not double it? And okay, it might not literally double your money, but it's going to have a significant impact on the revenue that you were able to generate. It's quite easy to explain to the talent that say, look, if you're up for doing this, you can increase your potential earnings by this much if you're up for doing it and doing a second episode. It's absolutely key to what we do. It's intense. We're not a massive company. This time last year, we were still like five people. Now we're probably like 25, but we're knocking out tens and tens of hours a week of podcasts. But this is the sort of model that we've hit on, and we've followed the audience and followed the appetite. And fortunately, we're still trending towards growth, which is great.
I guess on the way to figuring out the model, have you had any podcasts that started and haven't necessarily been as successful as the ones we've talked about? I noticed on your website, there's one with Stephen Fry and Stuart Broad, which I don't know whether that's still going or not, but you hear less about it. Whether there are some that you've learned lessons from and things don't always work out, and there are often good reasons for that.
The one that you're specifically referencing, that was a show that came out in 2018 that was kind of a one summer deal for a specific cricket event. But also in 2018, podcasting commercially in the UK was not where it is now. So that show worked for the summer in terms of it got pretty decent listenership and it was a good show, but it wasn't really making money. So there was no real impetus for the talent to carry on. So not all our shows have worked. And we're very fortunate with the scale that our biggest shows have gotten to, that sometimes we have to sort of recalibrate what our parameters are for success. We're trying to take an approach that, what do we want out of this show? Do we want this to reach a massive, broad audience? Obviously, we want our shows to reach as many people as possible. But for instance, last autumn, we launched The Rest is Money, which is finance, business, higher concept economic stuff as well. One of the reasons for doing that show was that the people who sold the ads for us were telling us how much interest there was from brands and sponsors around those kind of shows. And it absolutely has proven out. The audiences aren't as wide as The Rest is History and The Rest is Politics, but sort of pound for pound, it punches above its weight in terms of the sponsors it's able to attract and the revenue it's able to attract. So I think as long as we are clear about what we want from a show from the start, that's how we can avoid making any big missteps. But fortunately, no absolute howlers yet. A fair few that have not found an audience and we've quietly closed. But the last 18 months or so, our hit rate's pretty good.
Yeah, you're on a great streak. I would love for you to just to dream a bit. If, you know, in 10 years' time, we came back and had this conversation, what do you want Goalhanger to look like?
We're probably one of the biggest podcast first companies in the US as well as in the UK. Even in the last year, our conception of what a podcast is evolving so much. I'm talking about podcasts and shows, but in reality, we want all of our podcasts to become 360 media propositions where you can listen to the audio if you're, you know, on the train to work, or you can watch it on YouTube, or you can consume it on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you are. It's just really great content and it's optimized for however you want to consume that. What I guess I'm saying is that that's probably more of viewing ourselves as like a publisher than it is as like an independent production company, which is what we started life as. The potential that we can see from something like YouTube, and we're nowhere near doing this, but just the hints that you can get from how you're pushed algorithmically and the ways you can tailor that. And I can see if we can learn how to do that well and optimize it and do it for all the pods and do that for all platforms, there's gigantic potential there. And even just looking across to the state of play in the US, CPMs are a lot lower over here. Not necessarily lower, but there's just a lot fewer advertising dollars, I guess, in the UK for our kind of content. I think the total size of the UK podcast advertising market is something like £60 or £70 million. In the US, it's probably a couple of billion dollars. The UK is small, but it's not that much smaller that it should be that way. So I think the potential of brands and agencies over here becoming more switched on to our content compared to the traditional linear TV and radio world that still dominates. If we are in the position that we're in now, as that trend continues and we see more advertising dollars coming towards us, then it's just a huge opportunity for us. I'm very excited about it. I'm very sort of bullish on the future.
You're well on your way and we'll be rooting for you as you do it. Congratulations on everything to this point. I'm sure there's a lot more to come, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thoughts on a competitor coming onto your turf?
Well, it has me rethinking if we should be having some conversation shows that are running multiple times a week, because I was impressed to hear their growth, their numbers, the success that they have rolling new things out. And that is a noticeable difference versus how we do it, but pretty impressive.
It's a really interesting model that they have come to, where you're relying on two people to talk about topics that have endless things to dig up, whether it be history or politics or current affairs and finance. And if you have two knowledgeable people that have an audience already, and you just say, hey, record two things a week based on what might be in the news, or go back through the archives and tell us about these things from history. And it's been really successful and they've done a really good job. Those shows are all very good to listen to. Kudos to them.
Big time. There's something there just in terms of the format, how you're delivering things, the cadence at which you deliver it. It does have me thinking that there's certainly some attractive things about that model. I think your point on the people that they bring in, the hosts, often have big audiences themselves, is an important thing too. That speeds things up for sure.
It's funny because the one that kicked it all off, The Rest Is History, I think they were quite well-known historians, but they didn't really have an audience. But their chemistry and their depth of understanding of history built them a really big audience. Gary has an audience. They can point people at The Rest Is History guys, but they have organically grown. And I think that's one of the shows that people are most passionate about. If I talk to my friends and people nearby here, definitely not a risk. And they clearly know what they're doing far better than I do. But you kind of still want to find those people that are still slightly under the radar, if you like, where the podcast is going to be their main passion project. And that's not to say it isn't for the other people, but how do you balance that going forward will be an interesting thing for them to think about.
I just need to follow up. How many historians are you familiar with?
Off the top of my head, four.
Really? Who can you name?
Dan Snow. And I'll leave the rest to the listener's interpretation.
Fair enough.
He actually has his own podcast network as well, Dan Snow Chap. that's totally irrelevant to this discussion, but I thought I'd throw that in there.
I do think your point on almost creating new stars versus taking stars in, because as we saw from Spotify more generally, just giving celebrities a podcast does not always work. It can work if you have the guys at Smartless and the amount of time that they put into it. But most people, if they're showing up just as a side gig and because everybody told them they should have a podcast, not likely to lead to a good outcome.
Shouldn't be underestimated how powerful the incentive system that they've got. It's really simple. I think it's been published in papers saying they basically give a third to each host and they take the last third. That does tie them in for the long haul and say the more you do, the better it will be for you. And they clearly now have very good case studies. And I think the hosts themselves, whether it be the Rest is History people, he said they're earning seven figures. They're their best marketing engine for a new good host to come into the organization because they can see how it is done effectively. And then you just create a very simple structure like that and the rewards should follow.
Yeah, it was all very interesting. And to hear the 5,000 to 10,000 seat stadiums selling those out, that's impressive. It's backed up by the numbers. They're doing a really great job over there.
Yeah, and if they can find advertising to cover the fixed cost of hiring the stadium in the first place, then everything they sell is just upside rather than a different model. I think they were out in Australia and New Zealand as well doing things, so they're truly global, particularly with the History podcast. The cadence thing is interesting because it shouldn't be underestimated how it's easy to say, oh, the more podcasts you do, the more money they make, the better it is for everyone. That's not straightforward. Doing multiple podcasts on the same topic week in, week out takes some doing, and many of the hosts have other things that they do. They're traveling. They might want a week or two's break. It happens to everyone, but it's impressive. I talk about being impressive when people record podcast conversations that are 3 or 4 hours long. This is impressive in a different way, where if you're showing up week in, week out, doing multiple episodes, that's to be applauded.
They do their homework. I would never take away from that, but having a conversation style podcast, I think, is definitely maybe an advantage there versus an interview style, which can be a bit of a drag. And what you notice is that people tune in for a lot of different things with those conversation style podcasts. So there's a looser feeling to it. But I've noticed that, bring up The Ringer as a US example, where you will have the second show of the week sometimes. You can hear there's many more tangents on those episodes than you would get if they were fully focused on whatever they were discussing. So it is interesting.
Rogan is probably even more impressive when you think about it, that he basically has a guest on every single show and he's in the thousands of episodes at this point. And every podcast we've ever talked to on this show and privately, maybe they start off as bringing guests on because that's how you start to build an audience, and they realize more and more time, like the thing that they control is themselves. And that's what people tend to come for, is themselves. So they'll find creative ways to make more of their content just themselves talking about stuff. Whereas he has been steadfast in like bringing people on. That actually is incredibly cool.
It truly is. It's impressive. All these years later, to still be sticking to it.
It's funny what he said about the website, because the website is really bad. I'm sorry, Jack. Yeah. I'm sure you'll change that and it'll be really good. But it's funny that you have such a huge audience. It speaks to the nature of podcasting. People don't go to the website. Maybe to get to the membership, they have to, but they meet you in Spotify or an Apple Podcasts or Overcast or wherever. And so it doesn't really matter what your website looks like. And if you're making good money with a huge audience and your website looks like that, then that's also a pretty fun stat.
Busted, not broken.
Yeah. No, busted but booming.
Busted but booming, excuse me. Well, it's still busted but booming and not broken.
Yeah.
It all ties together. That's right.
Now, enjoy that one. Give you a bit of English culture there.
Yeah, I enjoyed it myself. Yeah, thanks for getting him on here.
Anytime. Cool. We'll see you soon, I think.
Yes, indeed. On to next week.